Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Siebel. Baseball, are you a sports fan? Are you a person that whenever the season rolls around, you can hardly wait to get to the stadium and get that hot dog, popcorn, peanuts, soft drinks, whatever it is, and settle in to watch a game that actually excites you? You can hardly wait to see it. Well, I have to be honest. I am not a baseball fan, basketball fan, football fan. That's not my particular area of strong interest. However, when I received a book called Shipwrecked, A People's History of the Seattle Mariners, I was intrigued. One, because this is in my own neighborhood, so to speak. But two, because it gives us the what I call the back room view of what goes on in an industry, because sports is a big industry. What happens there, the good, the bad, and the ugly. My guest today is John Wells, and again, his book is Shipwrecked. And I think it's a fascinating read about a team that, well, has quite a history behind it. John, I want to welcome you to the show.
Oh, glad to be here.
I was so intrigued with this book, and as I've just said, I am not a big sports fan. You, on the other hand, have a passion for this sport. You absolutely love it. You have been involved deeply with it, reporting on it, writing about it for 17 years. What is it? Were you just a kid that when you were growing up, you were playing baseball out in the streets with a stick and a ball made out of paper? What got you fascinated with this sport?
Oh, well, I've been a baseball fan ever since I was, six, seven, 8 years old, somewhere in there. Following the game and the players and live, breathe, and eat baseball. You know, it's been a big fan for a long, long time.
Now, you, interestingly enough, are a former entertainment attorney.
Yes.
Which I really thought was quite an interesting contrast, but you're a man that really wanted to get into the facts behind the Mariners team. You are in Seattle. You live in Seattle yourself. What made you decide that you were going to become something like an investigative reporter relative to this team? Why is this important to you?
Well, I've been covering this team for 17 years, and going to the games, and one of the reasons. I guess one of the biggest reasons is that the media in Seattle has basically enabled the Mariners to be like they are, because the media in Seattle is very soft. Most of the media in Seattle looks the other way, and tends to accentuate the positive and not really focus on the negative. The Mariners have these two fellows that have been running the team for a long, long time, and they've been doing a terrible job, yet they still keep their cushy positions. I come from the East Coast, and on the East Coast, these guys would have been run out of town long ago. I'm speaking of the team's chairman and CEO, Howard Lincoln, and the team's president and chief operating officer, Chuck Armstrong.
You have such a strong positioning on this. What I found particularly fascinating was all of the detail in your book regarding not just the game itself, but the history of the game. And as you said, you've been studying this for 17 years, and you've interviewed people, you have gotten your facts together, you have a tremendous magazine where you keep people informed. You're one of these rare people that's not afraid to stand out from the crowd and say, these are the facts. This is what I think you should know about. This is what's going on. And we'll get into some of the history here. You say, the Mariners at one time had one of the best hitting teams in the league and some of the worst pitching known to man. Their games were like slugfests. And he said, you said it was just really good at some times. However, in the past 10 years, the Mariners in positioning have sunk so low in their performance that in the baseball world, nobody really pays any attention to them. Now, I was hearing some things broadcast about the Mariners just recently which sounded just the opposite. Are they starting to come back now? Are they getting some of this influx of energy and attitude that's going to bring them to the forefront? Or is this still the pattern that this team has?
Well, we hope that they're improved, and we hope that they're on the way back. But the path they're taking is one that's not a sure thing. You know, they could speed up their so-called rebuilding process by acquiring some veteran players on the free agent market, but they've chosen over the last 4 years to continually reduce the payroll. Their payroll is now $35 million less than it was in 2008, just 4 short years ago. You know, that's kind of a recipe for disaster. Young players are young players. They're inconsistent. They're learning. And very, very few teams in the history of baseball have ever had success going with all young players. It just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Right. The same thing, you can equate it to a degree to football. One of the things in football, once they develop a good team, they realize that they have to keep an eye out for the development of another team because that one team that might be the winning combination of individuals. And baseball is a team sport, just like football is. If you don't have a good team, you're really going to suffer deeply, tremendously, because it takes everybody working together, even though there's a diversity of skill sets, and you work with them accordingly. It's really something, and in many sports, that's what a lot of coaches do. They look at bringing the young in with the older players because the older players have experience and wisdom and understanding of certain things, and there needs to be that growth development that's going to keep a very healthy patterning for a long period of time. Now, you mentioned that the people that own the Mariners have made well over $100 million in the game, and they're very oriented towards the profit level. Well, anybody would say if they were in business, if you don't check your bottom line, you're going to have a real difficulty. Yet in your book, you really emphasized how they seem to forget about the people that were buying the tickets. Those people that are loyal, that are buying the tickets, that's your audience. Those are the supporters of your business. And if you lose that, and they had lost a lot in attendanceship, do you find that that's still the case? Do you find that, I know there's always going to be the diehards, but do you find that there's been less and less interest in the game because of the poor performance?
Well, sure. I mean, you just need to look at the attendance. In 2002, they were number one in the major leagues in attendance among 30 clubs, more attendance than even a team like the New York Yankees, which has a lot more money than the Mariners. This year, the Mariners are 28th out of 30 teams in baseball. They've gone down from 3.5 million fans in 2002 to about 1.9 million last year, and it's probably going to dwindle another couple hundred thousand this year.
So there's an economic loss to the community, because when you have a sports team in a community that has a big draw, it benefits all the way around. The economics ripple out to small businesses of all types, whether it be the pubs that supply food after the game or before the game. There is this tremendous environment economically that surrounds that. And I know right now there's a lot of controversy regarding a new stadium and all kinds of stuff, and we won't go into that right now. But this is something that for people that are interested in trying to look at why things don't succeed, whether it's in baseball or anything else, there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes. How were you able to get into the back room area to find out so many of the details that you have in your book called Shipwrecked?
Well, in a variety of ways. I've got sources, you know, close to the team, you know, some of whom work for the team. I've got a lot of the salary information and payroll information on what the team is spending is public and available. And basically, because I've been so close to it for so long, a lot of this information I knew before I even put the book together.
You mentioned someone in your book that is very special to the people in the Seattle area. He's a broadcaster, Dave Newhouse, and he passed away in November of last year. And I was really intrigued with the chapter on Dave Newhouse. How did you get to know him, and how did you find out about all this controversy that he experienced in his profession as a broadcaster, because he was with them for many, many years?
Well, I got to know him, very quickly after we started the magazine. He was one of my inspirations in starting the magazine, and I enjoyed his broadcasting and the passion he had for baseball. Got to know him as a person, shortly after we started the magazine. He was very supportive, and we became friends quickly. And he was a very, very nice man, and he saw the passion I had for baseball. As far as knowing about all the intricate details, some of that. That had gone on in his career. Some of that, came from talking to him, and some of it also came from speaking with his wife after his passing.
The players, one of the biggest players in the Mariners was Ken Griffey, and Ken Griffey Jr. His dad also played for the Mariners, didn't he?
Briefly,
Ken Griffey Sr.?
Yeah, his dad had a long career in the major leagues, and he played with the Mariners with his son for a couple of months.
But Ken Griffey Jr. was just dearly, dearly loved. Give us a little bit of history with him, because he was such a prominent player, with him and his career with the Mariners and what prompted him to leave.
A variety of factors prompted him to leave. I mean, he was the best player in baseball when he left, when he forced the trade in February of 2000 to Cincinnati. Part of it was family, certainly, and that was the stated reason. But another part of it was that he felt that the Mariners weren't giving him the best shot to win. Year after year during his first tenure here, the team would trade players away for financial reasons, and despite ever increasing attendance at the games, they would in essence cry poor and claim, well, we can't afford to keep this player, we have to trade him to one of our rivals, and that didn't sit well with a talent like Griffey and some of the other talents that left the team in the mid to late 90s. The team just wasn't doing what it needed to do to get to the next level. They had three Hall of Fame talents on the team all at the same time, and should have at least been to a couple of World Series and never even made one.
And that was really a major thorn in the side of a lot of the players, because they felt very discouraged. There were comments that were just very, very distressing by the players. Now let's talk about one of the managers, Lou Piniella. This is a man that had a phenomenal reputation. He came on with the Mariners. Why did Lou choose to become a part of the management for this team when it had such a discouraging reputation and patterning?
Well, it was a pretty big long shot that he would take on, come here. You know, what he initially said when they offered him the job in 1993 was, this isn't going to work. I've heard from everybody I respect in baseball that you go there and that's your career goes to die. And but ultimately he decided there was a challenge that he would accept and that he would take on. And it certainly helped that the Mariners had some good young talent at the time when he was hired as manager in 1993. Ken Griffey, Edgar Martinez, Randy Johnson, Jay Buhner were all in their 20s at the time, and becoming star players.
I have to chuckle when I think of one of the statements that you wrote about that he made with the team when he was so disgusted with them because they weren't performing the way he knew they could perform, and he stopped the bus that they were on. They were watching a bunch of children play baseball. He said that kids could beat them, could beat the Mariners as their own game. And I just laughed when I read that. But this was, he went through a lot of frustration with this team, but more with the management of the team than anything else. And he was able to pull out of a lot of the players the real good stuff that they had within them.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely, a very, very, very good motivator, and I've talked to players and over the years, and they loved playing for Lou. They would run through a wall for him. They would do anything, anything he asked. Play a position you've never played before. Sure, whatever you need, Skip. Pitch more innings than you've ever pitched before. You got it. He carried a lot of respect, both because he was a successful manager, but also because he had a long playing career.
Mm-hmm.
Where he was a hard nosed player for close to 20 years and for several teams.
You talked about Seattle being the nation's 12th largest television market in 1995. That was quite a statement. I wasn't aware that they were the 12th largest market. The median household income in 1995 was $40,000, and it was higher than all but seven of the markets in the country. There is a passion for baseball here. It's here. It's just absolutely phenomenal. But in 1995, there was a big setback because the longest baseball strike in history occurred. It was 232 days long. That really hurt the game, didn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of fans boycotted it afterwards. The attendance was down throughout most of baseball for quite a while. It took a few years to come back in most of the markets.
Let's talk about the Kingdome. Here in the Pacific Northwest, the Kingdome was the place for games. It was just an incredible building. However, it was not in too good shape because tiles were falling from the inside, and so there was going to be a new stadium built. And there was a lot of stuff that went on behind the scenes that the public did not know about. Give us a little bit of history on the Kingdome, the positives, the negatives of it, and what happened with what we now have as Safeco Field, because there was a lot of stuff that went on, even politically, regarding this.
Well, the Kingdome was... was built and debuted in 1976. And, you know, at the time it was considered a jewel, but it was really a substandard stadium. It contributed to the Mariners attendance woes throughout their first 15 or so seasons. In the middle of the summer, people would have to go indoors to watch a baseball game. It might be 75 degrees, and they'd have to go indoors to a climate controlled stadium where you know most of the stadiums throughout baseball are outdoor stadiums. It quickly became considered substandard a lot sooner than most stadiums. Only lasted 22, 23 years as a stadium, and it was imploded in March of 2000. The Mariners basically started a campaign shortly after the ownership group of Nintendo took over in 1992. They basically said, we need to have a higher revenues that a new stadium will bring us. The Kingdom didn't have very many luxury suites, which a team can sell to corporations for big bucks. And it just didn't have some of the revenue streams that these new ballparks that were sprouting up around baseball in the 90s did. Baltimore and Colorado and several other cities had built state-of-the-art ballparks by then, and the Kingdom was paled in comparison. As far as the controversy, during this season where the strike ended in 1995, it was a tremendous season for the Mariners. It was the first season they made the playoffs. But hanging over the team and their fans that season was the fact that the ownership had said, if we don't get a new stadium by the end of the year, or not a new stadium built, but if we don't get a new stadium committed to by the politicians, we're going to put the team up for sale, and they're probably going to move out of town. There was a vote, a referendum in September, and narrowly failed. But then the Mariners made the playoffs, and they beat the Yankees in the first round of the playoffs, and there was such a groundswell of support that they managed to get enough support in Olympia to push through a stadium, even despite the fact that the public had voted no.
That's right. Now, that's a very significant point, because I was here when that was going on. And in Seattle, in the state of Washington, the voters said, we are not going to put out more money for a stadium. It was voted down twice through the political manipulations in the state capital, Olympia. Gary Locke was the governor at the time. There was an additional tax that was put on without voters' approval to raise the money for this. People were just furious because we have here in the Pacific Northwest some of the highest taxes in the nation on multiple levels. And what was amazing was all of the detail you give in this book, which I think for anybody, if you're interested in what goes on behind the scenes politically, et cetera, this is a very good demonstration of what happened. The stadium, voters didn't want it. The stadium goes over budget. The Mariners are playing all kinds of verbal and political games. And I have your chapter here where you say, this is on the stadium issues, it became the most expensive stadium ever built to date in North America at a cost of $517 million. The Mariners agreed to cover all cost overruns, and this was promised. It was reaffirmed in July 98. The overruns at that time were $81 million. 2 months before the stadium opened, the team faced a $100 million bill for the cost overruns, and they tried to back out of it, but the public became furious. So they became the ones intimidated, and what was found out later, 2 years later, it was mostly those overruns were caused by the team itself. They were the ones that created the changes. And I read that and I said, wow, finally someone's come out with the truth that so many people had figured out and knew. This just was incredible to me. Now, you bring out a lot of points of information that anybody interested in sports, I think, would find fascinating, because it would apply not just to the Mariners, but to other teams as well. You talked about how the Mariners' revenues that came from a lot of other sources, it's not just T-shirts and popcorn and hot dogs. I mean, my goodness, it cost you $8 for a little puny hot dog at Safeco. I mean, remember the last time I was there and I saw $8 for a hot dog? You've got to be kidding. But that's what they do. They have these exorbitant costs, and it's going into somebody's pocket, but also their television deals that they have. And Seattle had a new national TV deal with NBC, ESPN. It went from $3.4 million in 95 to $7.4 million in 96, and I don't know what it is today. The price of tickets for a family, you have to plan on spending at least, at least $200 when you go to a game. That's a lot of money out of pocket. Do you think that'll ever become more? Do you think they'll ever shift out of that to making it so that it's more people-friendly, the game? Players seem to be so isolated anymore.
Well, I mean, there's definitely some teams that, you know, that are fan-friendly and look at things, you try and keep things reasonable. The Mariners have a division rival in Anaheim, the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, and their average ticket price this year is $19.70. The Mariners' average ticket price this year is $26.40.
Are you serious? I haven't been to ballgame in years. $26 and how many cents?
$26.40 is the average Mariners ticket this year.
Oh, my gracious.
The bizarre thing is that in the last 10 years, while the Mariners have been, you know, terrible, the Angels have been to the playoffs six times and won a World Series. And yet the Mariners' prices are 34% higher than the Angels' prices. Basically, what's happening is, you know, you talk about the high prices at the stadium, and, you know, most teams have that. So, you know, some charge more than others and take advantage more than others. But the most teams in baseball are pretty happy to get you in the door so they can sell you that $9 beer and that $8 hot dog. The mm-hmm. Mariners have taken the tack, even while they've been struggling on the field, that the prices are going to constantly go up. So they're like, you know, no, you're going to pay more to get in the door, and then we're going to gouge you once you get in.
Amazing. Amazing. This, and again, we're talking about business. I find it just so fascinating, and to those fans that are so loyal with their hearts, their support, their pocketbooks, I just think you're terrific. But my goodness, it's all relating to the bottom line. I know how much the game means to so many people. Baseball is an American game. Its history is absolutely phenomenal when you go and you study it. We live in a different world today, but I think the passion for the game is there because there is something special about people being able to whack a little tiny ball over the wall. There's an energy. Little boys, little girls still like baseball. They love to play it in school, love to play it on fields, in their parks. And they'll make up their own way of playing baseball. It just has a magic about it that continues to be and even grow in certain environments. John Wells, you are not just, you talk about the icons, the off-the-field icons, the tuba guy, the peanut man. You just give so much wonderful information in your book, but by golly, you're bare bones, down-to-earth real about so much that this team that achieves sometimes recognition that we wish it wouldn't get. Shipwrecked is the name of your book, A People's History of the Seattle Mariners. It's an understanding of baseball on multiple levels. Profits over peanuts. That's basically what he's trying to get information out about. John Wells, studying it for 17 years, go to his website, grandsalami.net. Grandsalami.net. You can find out about his magazine and much, much more. John Wells, thanks so much for sharing with us the part of the world that many Americans have a passion for, but not just Americans, Japanese, many people around the world love the game. And you give an insider's view that I think really is terrific. I appreciate having gotten your material and having you as a guest. Thank you so much. And continue your writing. People want to know more.
Thanks very much, Donna.
You're welcome, John. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't go away.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about the side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep at night because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have, cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without the side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you hurt. We want to help. We are so sure that Toprasin will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want the pain relief without the side effects, ask for Toprasin. Toprasin is available at Duane Reade, Quick Check Pharmacies, and Wegmans. Ask for Toprasin or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store near you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Toprasin, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Do you have a group, organization, or club that would like to have an interesting and dynamic speaker? Then you're going to want to have Donna speak to your group. She motivates audiences towards personal empowerment, giving them tools for their personal and professional success. If you would like Donna Sebo to bring a presentation to your next event, call Delphi International at 253-582-5604. That's 253-582-5604.
Hi, this is Donna. Welcome back. And if you would like to call in and chat with me, here is the telephone number to call in to, 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. I want to take a moment and thank the Chamber of Commerce in Linwood, Washington, for having me as a guest yesterday. It was just delightful to be able to speak before the group, and it was a marvelous experience. So I hope you enjoyed the program on the Lost Worlds of Ancient America that we did play because I wasn't able to do the show live. Well, I want to again give the number, 888-627-6008. Tomorrow we're going to be talking with Diane Collins about quantum thinking. And she's just got a very dynamic publication that I think you will really enjoy. And shifting your mind into that direction that's going to empower you, I think, always is a plus. I want to share with you some information about chilies and a recipe, so have that pad of paper and pen handy because I think you're really going to enjoy that. So that'll be coming up in a few minutes. But I wanted to give you a little bit of history. I know yesterday that you were listening to Frank Joseph, who is a historian, a man that is just amazing in his research. But I wanted to talk about some items that were found in New Jersey. Now, in 1990, there was a discovery of a freighter that sank during the early years of Imperial Rome off the Mediterranean coast of South France. Now, this really surprised archaeologists. They didn't know what to make of this. It flew in the face of what they have found in the past. They did not feel, according to our history as we knew it, that the Romans traveled very far. When they found this ship, not only was it extremely well-preserved, but the design of the ship was far more sophisticated than what they gave the Romans credit for. Well, anybody that knows anything about the architects and engineers of Roman times, these were people that were pretty sophisticated. The Romans, as conquerors of many different people, were smart enough to say, whatever the best is of the environment that we're conquering, we're going to absorb it. So they have learned architectural design, engineering, from many different cultures that they were brought in touch with. And that expanded their base. Not very much different from people coming into the United States from all over the world, getting their education, taking their education back to their own country, and implementing it. We are seeing the results of that with China, Japan, many other countries in the world. So we did the same with Germans after the last World War. We brought a lot of those brilliant people into the United States. They educated, they trained what they knew about giving us their technologies, etc. So this is nothing new. Now, with this discovery off the coast of France, they realized that during Caesar's time, contrary to popular historic tradition, these were seafarers that could have traveled anywhere in the world. Anywhere in the world. And guess what? They did. They came to the United States, and they were in New Jersey, ladies and gentlemen. How do we know this? Well, on April 15th, 2003, a scuba diver was checking out the seafloor off of New Jersey. He wanted to find shark fossils. They were known to be found in an area in the sands near a place called River Red Bank. Now, this was something that was well known to a lot of people. That's why this guy was there. But they also found all kinds of animal remains. This was in an area that wasn't too far from a place called Sandy Hook. However, the scuba diver, his name was Nelson Jika. 15 feet beneath the surface, this 55-year-old man pulled up a unique object from the ocean bottom. And I've got a picture of it in front of me. It was 4 inches long, weighed about 18 ounces, and it was a reddish stone. Now, it'd been in the water for a long, long time and buried. So it was eroded. However, it was a depiction of a man and a woman. He went, took it in for appraisal to a particular auction house in New York. And these experts examine all kinds of things. They classify, they buy, and they sell ancient artifact arts that are found. Now, he didn't tell them anything about where he found it. He didn't want anybody to have a clue. And this is what he was told. The Shark River artifact was a common fertility image made in Roman Egypt during the early 3rd century. It probably belonged to an Egypto-Roman sailor who reached New Jersey about 1,800 years ago. That was an eye-opener. Well, not only was that found in those sands in the water, but there was another man who was in Massachusetts, going along the coastline. He had a metal detector. He found 8 Roman coins within a single square yard on the beach. You know what? He had those checked, and they apparently were manufactured during the reigns of Emperor Constantinus II and Valentinius I. Valens and another one. I mean, here we've got this evidence. They said, historically, there were 58 emperors of Rome who issued some 3,000 kinds of coins commonly found in Europe, and the chances of a single find site yielding coins of consecutive rulers spanning only 4 decades can be estimated as roughly 1 in 100,000. I love it. What we're discovering is that people were traveling from points, and that we had visitors to this country a long time before Christopher Columbus ever came about. That's where many peoples ended up staying here. The Chinese ended up coming here. There are so many points of information we're learning about. This globe has been traveled by many, many, many seafarers long before we ever imagined it possible. And isn't it exciting? It breaks down paradigms. It takes away limitations. And it makes us aware that there's a history of this planet Earth and the peoples that have lived on it that is absolutely awesome. So I think as technology increases, and you've heard me say this before, we're able to find out more and more and more. So it is just amazing, and I wanted to share that particular story with you because New Jersey, who would have thought that we'd find something relating to ancient Rome in the waters there? But it's a fact. This is Donna Siebel. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 888-627-6008 is the telephone number to call in. All I need from you is your first name or your initial. And, of course, after that, you're welcome to ask me a question about anything that you like, anything that is on your mind and is of concern to you. Well, animals always have a tremendous impact on us. Our family is a real lover of Scottish Terriers. Of course, we really love dogs of all kinds, and we love kittens, too. However, how do animals have an effect on us, physiology? Lots of research has been done relative to this. We all know, those of us who are lovers of animals, how much they make a difference in our lives. Well, they're finding about children, dogs especially, help children to read and develop math skills. And they've done a couple of studies and found that young people, when they practiced reading aloud to their dogs, improved their skills 20% more than those who read aloud to other kids or adults. It just relaxes the kids. They feel like they've got a buddy there. It's absolutely marvelous. And it seems like kids, when they have pets, especially dogs, they seem to be more confident, set higher goals, and they sort of become more agreeable with their social environment. And what about cats? Cats are just absolutely the love of so many. Well, do you know what? They're learning something medically, scientifically, that they didn't know before. Sound frequencies of 20 hertz to 50 hertz, exactly the frequency range of a kitty's purr. Who would have thought? Actually increases bones, bone density. Now, we know that sound has a tremendous effect on healing and wellness for people. But a kitty's purr? Who would have thought? Well, cats, as you know, have tremendous agility. They have fewer bone fractures than dogs, less hip dysplasia, very little arthritis. But they are finding through science, through the studying of animals and interactions with people, these sound frequencies thicken the bones of people. They say it also, they have found when it comes to healing animals, that frequency, 20 to 50 hertz, makes a difference. It increases bone densities. Fascinating stuff. People coming from different positionings of thinking and making discoveries that for some we've already known about, but this is something that can have a big effect. Can you imagine going in, if you have a broken bone, and using sound to increase the vibratory factor within the bone and it heals 10 times more quickly than it would otherwise? Really something very, very special there. Protecting your heart also is a result of having a cat, same with a dog. The University of Minnesota Stroke Research Center found that when people, if they've had a severe stroke, when they have a cat, it is just an amazing benefit to them. Prevention for heart disease, if you have a kitty, makes a difference. Why? Because petting the cat or the dog lowers your stress level. It lowers the intensity of agitation that so often brings on problems with the heart. And who would have thought that children raised with animals would have less of a tendency with asthma? Well, they find that when children are exposed to animals at a younger age, it really helps them avoid the asthma challenge. And, of course, animals are always great to have around to keep you fit as a fiddle, by golly, you get out, you go for your walks. If you've got a bigger dog or if you've got a very athletic dog, maybe you run. It's really quite exciting. This is Donna Siebel. I'll tell you, with my Scotty, I've gotten to know a lot more neighbors. Think about that. People like to stop and talk to you when you have a dog, when you have a pet, when you're out with that animal. Makes a big difference. It really, really does. It's a great way to get to know your neighbors, keep you in shape, and put a smile on your face just because you have a chance to get out and say hello. Make new friends. This is Donna Siebel. We're taking a break. We're going to be back shortly. And when we come back, that phone line is open. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat, 888-627-6008. We'll be right back.
Have you ever had a friend tell you about a product they really believed in? Hi, this is Donna Siebel. Toprosin is a homeopathic cream that is just fabulous. I use it and my friends use it for relief of painful discomfort such as aching muscles and sore feet. Odorless, non-greasy, it is a product that belongs in everyone's medicine cabinet and first aid kit. Check out www.toprosin.com. That's T-O-P-R-I-C-I-N. And find out more information. You can order Toprosin online or call 800-959-1007. That's 800-959-1007. Be sure to give them the code DS30 and you'll receive a 30% discount. Toprosin, non-toxic, safe for children too. This is a product that really works. Try it. I think you'll like it.
Donna Siebel publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna. Chilies have been a very important part of people's diets in different parts of the world, South America especially. That's where a lot of chilies came from. Chili peppers are thought to have originated in the northern Amazon basin. Now, they're indigenous throughout Central America, South America, the West Indies, and a lot of the southern states in the United States. But a lot of this came about because of trade through thousands of years. And chilies have been many times a form of preservative when it comes to food. Now, there is a pepper called a tepin. That's a T-E-P-I-N, or chili tepin pepper. And it's one of the oldest varieties in the world, and this chili is often called the mother chili. It grows wild in northern New Mexico, and it has spread through the generations up into Arizona and Texas. And in Texas, it's considered the state chili, from what I understand. It's very, very hard, though, to raise it domestically for whatever reasons. It's not an easy item to grow. And it likes inhospitable, harsh environment. Go figure. You never know what Mother Nature is going to produce in different areas. But this particular chili really likes areas that are dry, like the Sonoran Desert. And they find in the wild, the desert oak or the mesquite tree is what it really thrives under. And it fruits up for 20 years. It's that prolific in production. They will thrive forever, chilies will, if they have a place that they love. They adopt it, that's it, and they just are prolific in production afterwards. Now, there's also a lot of information regarding chili, the Aztecs, and that was very much a part of their diet. And there is a drink the Aztec emperors loved, and it was a combination of chili and chocolate. I don't know about you, that made me pucker a little bit when I read about that combination. But it really is something that makes a difference in everybody's diet. Now, why are chilies important? There's all kinds of chilies, all types of heat, but why are they so significant in a person's diet? Well, they're low sodium, low calorie, They're high in vitamins A and C. They have folic acid in them, potassium, and vitamin E. They have a traditional history of being a remedy for all kinds of things, and it's various aspects of chilies have been used for asthma, arthritis, blood clots, people that have cluster headaches, shingles, burns. Now, one of the things about chilies that I think is unique is they contain about twice the amount of vitamin C that's found in citrus fruits. They contain more vitamin A than carrots. So when you have your chili relleno in your restaurant, your favorite place, know you're getting a lot of nutrition with that. And fresh green chilies, they'll give up to 240% of an adult's recommended daily allowance of vitamin C. So they are just absolutely awesome. Well, what I wanted to do was really give you a wonderful recipe, and this is for roasted tomatoes with chili, bay, and thyme. And this is a recipe that the people of Tuscany really, really enjoy. And it's so easy to fix. And I'll tell you, you can use this for topping bruschetta. This is a wonderful, wonderful recipe for an appetizer. Great for a light summer dish if you wanted to fix it, and it's terrific even if you wanted to have homemade pizza or pasta. It's absolutely amazing. Now, this is what you're going to need. You're going to need about 8 tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil, and you're going to need 2.5 pounds of nice ripe tomatoes. Your big beefsteak tomatoes would work wonderfully with this. You're going to need 4 garlic cloves. You want to, when the skin's on, you want to smash them with the skins on. Leave the skins on. You have 3 fresh bay leaves. You need 2 sprigs of fresh thyme, 2 teaspoons of balsamic vinegar, 1/2 of a hot red chili. You want to chop that really fine. You need celery salt and freshly ground black pepper, and you're going to need a little bunch of your favorite herbs, such as rosemary or oregano. You chop it up, whatever is your favorite. And then you're going to need a large, heavy ceramic baking dish. Now, you need to preheat your oven to about 325 degrees. Now, this is what you're going to do. This is so easy and so deliciously flavorful. You're going to take 1 tablespoon of the oil. You lightly grease your ceramic dish. Non-stick cooking spray would work just as well. Cut your tomatoes in half vertically from the stem down. You want to put them in your baking dish cut side up. Your garlic cloves and bay leaves you want to put in between the tomatoes. Then you add your thyme and pour the remaining oil evenly all over the top of the tomatoes. You want to make sure that every single tomato is well coated with the olive oil. And then you take the vinegar, the balsamic vinegar. I don't think I mentioned that. You need about 2 teaspoons of that. You want to sprinkle it over the top of your tomatoes after you've coated them with oil. Then you want to take your chilies and scatter them evenly across the tomatoes and season the entire dish with your celery salt and black pepper. You can use Celtic salt, too, if you wanted anything that is your favorite, if your favorite salt. And then you want to take your chosen herbs, whichever is your favorite, chop them up finely, put them right over the top of the tomatoes. Now, your oven, you need to roast these tomatoes for about 2 hours. Now, when they're cooked, they're going to be lightly browned on the top, and it's going to be a lot of juice. If it looks like they're burning, you need to check on them. And again, this is baking in the oven for about 2 hours. You need to check on them and just turn the heat down, because everybody's oven is different. And while it's still hot, once you remove them from the oven and they're cooked, then you gently squeeze each tomato with the back of a fork to release more of the juices. And you need to do it gently because the juices will spurt up on you. Let it cool. The caramelized sugar of the roasted tomatoes will thicken. Combining with your herbs, oil, and vinegar, it'll make a delicious sauce. They can be served warm or cold. Hot, crusty bread is absolutely great. So all you have to do is have something like this, flavorful, delicious, perfect, just about any time, and healthy. Little bit of history on chilies. I know we are just about out of time. This is Donna Siebel. Remember, always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. God bless. Have a wonderful day. We'll be back with you tomorrow. Same time, same place. We'll be discussing quantum thinking. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Siebel Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Siebel Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.